This is in his Veniaminov. I admire him so much for all the heroic missionary work he did in Alaska. But I'm always moved, as you can tell, by reading this speech. Because in addition to his genius, his greatness, his real greatness as a modern apostle, he was so incredibly humble. This humility shines through everything he does as Metropolitan of Moscow. It's absolutely extraordinary. And then he organized the Orthodox Missionary Society that same year. In the same cathedral, he gathered all the potential donors and interested parties, priests and laymen, who might be interested in missionary work. Well, this is something he knew something about. And he gives them a real pep talk. What is the purpose, he says, of our missionary society? I won't read you that whole text. But he, what's the point of organizing a missionary society? He says, certainly for the support of the missions, we know that. And especially, of course, you expect me to say, to write out your checks, you know, for the physical, for the financial support of the missions. They need chalices, they need shrouds, they need vestments, they need candles, they need money to build churches, we need bells, we need pamphlets, we need books, we need church school materials, we need Bibles, yes. But none of these will guarantee the ultimate success of our effort. We need missionaries, we need well-trained teachers, but that too will not guarantee the success of our missions. What do we really need to do most of all as members of this mission society? And he says, I'll tell you this. We can never tell what draws a person to Christ and to sincere conversion and what doesn't. It's not the efficacy of our preaching. It's not how slick our materials might be or how many we've got. That's not it. It's a mystery how God draws one person to himself and others fail to heed the invitation. This is in the hands of God, not in our hands. Yes, we need the materials. Yes, we need the money. We need the missionaries. We need the books. But most of all, we need prayer. Pray, first of all, that God will supply our missionaries with whatever they need and will supply us with capable and dedicated men to work on these in these frontiers. But pray also for those who need to be drawn to the faith. Pray that the Holy Spirit will enkindle love of God and faith in their hearts. Pray for that. That's what our society must be dedicated to first of all, and then everything else will take care of itself. What a marvelous speech this is. Because having lived on the frontier and having baptized and converted so many, he realized it's really not me as the preacher. It's not me as the teacher, no matter how many Aleut Bibles I can pass out. It's really from God, and it's a mystery of the Holy Spirit, and therefore we need to pray. And in this respect, everyone must be dedicated to missionary work. Because even if you're staying home, and even if you're sick, and even if you have no money to give, you can still be an active member of our missionary society because you pray for those not yet converted and those not yet drawn to the Lord. And so therefore, we must be mostly a society of prayer. What a wonderful beginning. He had all his priorities so right. The same year, 1868 was a significant year in St. Innocent's life. He was still in Yakutsk. He hadn't gotten the telegram to bring him to Moscow yet. And he wrote a letter to the Oberprokurator of the Holy Synod, the secular head of the committee that actually ran the Russian church at that time, because there was no patriarch. And he writes, rumor reaching me here, he doesn't say from where. It's very hard to get a rumor out to Yakutsk. I have no idea how this rumor reached him. But anyway, that's how it starts. Rumor reaching me here purports that I have opposed the sale of our Alaskan colonies to the United States, which have already happened, and the transfer ceremony already took place the year before, 1867. Nothing could be further from the truth. However, if I were to be asked, nobody had, we could point that out, but if I were to be asked, this is what I would recommend. And he writes four or five recommendations, the first of which is, do not close the American mission. I see this sale as the means by which our holy faith will penetrate the other parts of America. I would, however, transfer the headquarters of our mission from Sitka to San Francisco. The climate is infinitely better. And as far as communications with St. Petersburg, it's just, if not better, just as adequate, or if not better, out of San Francisco than Sitka. Secondly, I would recall the bishop now in Sitka and send to America a bishop who speaks the English language, and send with him priests and clergy who are also familiar with English, so that services as quickly as possible will be conducted in English, thereby intelligible to Americans who will be drawn to our faith. Thirdly, allow this bishop, without further communication with St. Petersburg, to ordain those Americans who come to us qualified to be clergy of the Orthodox Church in America. This is the first time we have this phrase, Orthodox Church in America. So St. Innocent says, it's good Alaska has become part of the USA. Now Orthodoxy can spread there. And we need service books in the English language, clergy who serve in English, and preferably a cathedral and a bishop in San Francisco. And they did it all. In 1868, they built the first cathedral in San Francisco. And the bishop who went spoke English. By 1905, there were dozens of parishes in the lower 48. But the majority of them by then were being founded by immigrants coming in from the other side, across the Atlantic. And so Patriarch, then Bishop Tichon, transferred the headquarters of the mission from San Francisco to New York. About the same time, they ordained the first Antiochian bishop, Bishop Raphael, who was Arabic but also Russian educated and Russian speaking, to be specifically the bishop for the Arabic speaking Christians in the United States. They ordained a Serbian bishop to be specifically the bishop to minister to the Serbian Orthodox Christians in the United States. They published books mostly in English, and it was called the American Orthodox Messenger. And only later, as more immigrants came, especially after the Russian Civil War, the Revolution and Civil War, they were forced by pastoral necessity to use primarily Russian language in their publications. But it didn't start out that way. And it was all St. Innocent's vision. This old man sitting in Moscow already saw very clearly where the church had to go in America. A prophetic vision of where we had what we have to do in America. And when you read this, you say, and folks, he wrote this in 1868, 129 years ago. And it's just, people are saying, well, you know, we better get on with it, right? There were a few complications, wars and revolutions and mass migrations of people that have, but the vision is still there, and it's St. Innocent's. About 10 years actually before he died, St. Innocent wrote out his last will and testament because he knew that his eyesight was failing and there wouldn't be any chance if he didn't do it in 1869 or 70 already. He had written out what to do with his belongings. He didn't own that much. He ordered a panagia, a bishop's icon, to be sent to the cathedral in Irkutsk and another one to be sent to the, in his memory, to the Sitka Cathedral. But otherwise, everything went to his son, who was already ordained priest. And he ordered that he be buried in a simple grave in the plot of the monastic brotherhood at St. Sergius Lavra. They didn't do that. They put him in a marble tomb next to Metropolitan Philaret. And there he slept until 1977, where at the request of the Alaskan Diocese of the Orthodox Church in America, the Russian Orthodox Church canonized him October 6th as St. Innocent, Apostle to the Aleuts, Enlightener of the Aleuts, Apostle to America. The succeeding bishops had the title, and the Aleuts love this, Bishops of the Aleutian Islands and North America. Bishop of the Aleutian Islands and North America, because it focused on the heritage of St. Innocent Veniaminov. These are extraordinary men. What do we have to learn from them as it applies to our missionary work now? I think St. Innocent's Mission Society speech is one. That prayer for the success of the mission and the conversion of souls is integral to the success of any missionary effort. And in that sense, we can all participate in missionary work, even at home, even quietly in the closet, so to speak. But more importantly, their lives focused on two things, the indigenization of the gospel in Native Alaskan cultures and educational work. Thanks to the Orthodox Church's work, missionary work, educational work in Alaska, Native Alaskans not only became the mainstay of the church, But in the last 40 years of Russian rule, of the Russian period, they really ran the colony. There were never more than 700 ethnic Russians in the entire state at any one time, and most of them were coming and going. But those early Promyshleniks who had intermarried with native Alaskans raised hundreds of kids. And remember, the company was responsible for them. So for the next two charters, at no cost to themselves, those children were sent to first small schools in their hometowns, Atka, Unalaska, Bielkovsky, Kodiak, and so forth, all had small parish schools run by their parish priest. They were bilingual schools. The books were both in Russian and in the native languages. And the best students were sent to the all-colonial school in Sitka for six more years of training. Most of Alaska was mapped by graduates of the all-colonial school. Even the North Slope was first put on the maps of the world by graduates of the all-colonial school, some of whom did so well there, they were scholarshiped to the Russian Naval Academy in Kronstadt in the Baltic. In 1979, I told you last night, I was accused of being a revisionist historian because people believe a la Bancroft that Aleuts were nothing but slaves, oppressed for the entire 127-year period of the Russian era. It's not true. 27 years, yes, by Baranov's time. But there's 100 more years, 50 years before and 50 years after, that have to be taken into account. The 50 years earlier, I say, is a big question mark. We just don't have the records and haven't done the research. But it's not the black and bloody period that Bancroft would have us believe. The 50 years after, however, we have lots of records in our own libraries of the Aleuts, usually with Slavic surnames, who were sailing around the world in Russian-American company ships, who were the sea captains and the navigators. And when I told people 22 years ago that there were Aleut sea captains visiting Rio de Janeiro, they said, obviously that's preposterous, you're making that up. But we have their names. You see, to get to Russia from Alaska, you either had to sail to Australia and around Cape Hope, the tip of Africa, and the whole length of the Atlantic Ocean that way, or you had to sail south to San Francisco, and usually Santiago, Chile, and then through the tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, around the tip there, and also the whole length of the Atlantic Ocean to get. But either way, it was not an easy trip. And the Aleut sea captains always took the South American route, and it's because I think they like to vacation in Brazil. There were Aleut explorers who mapped not only the interior rivers of Alaska, but they mapped the North Slope. Alexander Kashevarov, who retired as a major general in the Russian military, was responsible with Nikolai Chernov, mapping the area from Point Hope to Point Barrow and a little bit beyond. They went up here in Russian sailing vessels, but they took enough kayaks with them. So when the ice started closing in early in the fall, they got into their kayaks and continued their exploration. It was because they were native Alaskans they had the know-how to do this. They had the best of both worlds. They knew all the mathematics and navigational stuff, and they knew how to draw the maps from what they had learned at school, but they knew how to maneuver their kayaks through the ice because they were native Alaskans. The men who operated the trading posts in the interior during St. Yakov's time were all people of mixed Russian, or we should more appropriately say, Siberian ancestry and native Alaskan mothers. And their kids moved further and further in, becoming those interpreters, that whole network of contacts that St. Yakov enjoyed as he moved inland to evangelize the native people of the interior. So they were all in cahoots. Mr. Lukin, a common name from Afognak and Port Lions even to this day, Semyon Lukin, ran the trading post on the Kuskokwim. His son Constantine was the one who found the caribou I already mentioned. And his older son, Ivan, was sent by the Russian American Company as a spy. We have the first espionage in Alaska history. A native Alaskan, an Aleut, put on Indian clothes, easily obtained downriver, paddled upstream in a birch bark canoe and pretended to be one of the Indians coming to the trading post at Fort Yukon, Hudson Bay Company, inside the Alaskan boundary. The Russian American Company wanted to know what they were doing, how many they were, and how serious this intrusion from Canada into Alaska was. Ivan Lukin went there twice, they never caught him, wrote up reports and sent them back to Sitka, detailing exactly what was going on at Fort Yukon, how many Canadians or Englishmen were there, if there were soldiers and so forth. We have the first espionage case in Alaska. Aleuts. I mentioned to you that this Aleut identity is something complicated, like the Swiss. But very quickly, before the break, I want to quickly put up here the last of the kind of secular information for anthropological data of this presentation. These people who call themselves Aleut are Unangan speaking, Sukhirak speaking, and much to my dismay, at least at first, Yupik speaking. I was around Iliamna Lake at the village of New Halen, a tiny community on the north shore of Iliamna Lake. And there was a woman there for some reason filling out some census data or something like that, a survey. And they asked for her ethnic background, and she wrote Aleut. And I said to her in Yupik, "You're Aleut." She said, "Yes." I said, "Were your relatives originally from out in the Aleutian Islands?" I'm thinking Unangan. She said, "No." "Well, then were some of your relatives from this area?" Sukhbiak background. She said, "No." I said, "Well, if you're not from here and you're not from here, you can't be Aleut." She said, "Yes, I am." This woman was confused, it seemed to me. These people call themselves, remember, the Eskimo Aleuts, the Japanese Aleuts, but now we have another group claiming to be Aleut. This was going too far. And we were speaking in Yupik at the time. And then it hit me. The lady with whom I was arguing her own ethnic identity had this name, Akwilina Tretyakov. Akwilina Tretyakov, huh? There's a common denominator here. And the first is Siberian contact. Siberian, not only contact, of course, but intermarriage. And very early on in this contact period, bilingualism. The kids and the grandchildren spoke their own native language, plus Russian, and Russian became the way in which they could communicate across the tribal boundaries, which was impossible before contact. And then, not only bilingualism, but thanks to the work of Father Gideon, St. Herman, and certainly eventually St. Yakov Nesvyatov, St. Innocent Veniaminov, and the others, biliteracy. Literacy in both their native language and Russian, which gave them their entree into the libraries of the world. Not without renouncing their native Alaskan culture and language, they were also able to adapt and accept as necessary job skills things like navigation, medicine, cartography, and the rest. And this led them, well, of course, we can add to all of this, this is all through the auspices of the Orthodox mission. So they all become Orthodox Christians. And then, professional status. These are the blue and white collar workers of the colony. By the time the 1840s come around, Kodiak is a 90% Native Alaskan community. 10% Russian, Siberian, 90% Native. They're running the stores, they're sailing and building the ships, they're navigating they're conducting the commerce. The Kodiak people were selling ice to people in San Francisco. Before the age of artificial electronic refrigeration, the meat packers in California desperately needed ice just to keep their produce fresh enough to sell. And so they sold tons of Kodiak Lake ice, which they towed from Kodiak Lakes over the beaches. The ruts at Woody Island are still there. And they towed this ice to San Francisco. They made thousands of dollars in profits selling ice to the meat packers in San Francisco. It came from Alaska. And the Aleuts were doing it. Professional status included all the clergy, the school teachers, the translators. We have a long list of accomplished people, artists, musicians. Even Baranov had a chamber orchestra in his day. And the people who played the viola and the violin and the cello were Native Alaskans. So there was music, there were art, there were the arts, there was education, there was exploration, there was commerce, there was the church, and the Aleut people were actively involved of all of this. They weren't simply the bystanders or the innocent victims of history, they were active participants. And the Orthodox mission made that possible. So we have all of these characteristics, and then after 1867, you have federal suppression. federal U.S. suppression, an all-out attack on this culture. So that when I came to Alaska, I saw in the elders the last glimpse of this. One could say, in fact, that was the loss of one of the elders in this category, in Akenti Shugak in Old Harbor, that brought me here, because his death in 1968 was what provoked the determination on the part of that community to build a house and put aside a salary and do something. And I was told when I arrived that they expected me to run Aleut school. I had no idea what Aleut school was. I knew nothing of this history I've just outlined with you. So I went ahead and did kind of OCEC, Orthodox religious education. And people were pretty pleased with that, but I could tell the elders weren't completely satisfied. As I stayed in the village, I began to learn certain hymns like Holy God and Our Father a little bit, Glory to the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the doxology. I learned some of these things in Aleutic. And at the end of the summer, kind of to show off what all the kids had learned, they put up the things that they had drawn and painted in crafts and such. But they also sang in the church Holy God in Slavonic, Aleut, and English. And it was after that the grandparents came to me and said, "We're so glad, Michael, you finally got it right." This is what they want. Aleut school meant all these things. To be Aleut means to take pride in the Slavonic, Siberian, Russian tradition. It means also to be proud to be loyal American citizens. And it also means to embrace one's own ethnic cultural heritage. And one can say the Aleut language, Aleut languages are Russian, English, and either Udnangan or Sukhpiak or Yupik. And people throughout Southwest Alaska who call themselves Aleut are not just confused about where they came from or who their ancestors were. The very name Aleut comes from Siberia. To identify Aleut, very much like being Swiss, is not a matter of language, but a matter of history and culture. And there has been and still is, to some extent, the remnants of an organic and authentic Orthodox Christian culture in Southwest Alaska. So when people say, "I'm Aleut," I say, "Me too." Because to be Aleut is a kind of state of mind. And the essence of this state of mind, this attitude, is addition. We have our native culture. You want to teach us how to be things, elements that are useful to us, that are from Siberia or Russia, fine, we'll add that. Someone else comes and says, "You want to teach us English, and we're going to learn things from American culture that will also be useful, relevant to our needs," fine, we'll add that. When the federal suppression began, it was no more Russian, no more Aleut, just speak English. And the Aleuts resisted. We have 50 years of resistance, petitions, letters, court cases. You see, they were literate. Everybody else could have their kids taken away from them, but the Aleuts said, "No, we're not taking my kids. We're citizens of this country, and we're not taking this lying down." They didn't win very many cases, but we have their protests. We have their response to all of this, some of which we'll read tomorrow. But we have real, one could say, social activist Native Alaskans saying, "This is wrong. You can't do this to us. You can't suppress our language. It's a free country. We have this culture, we have this faith, we've been at it for 100 years. It's ours, it's our pride, it's our identity. We have a right to it." They lost, actually, but at least they fought back. And we have their written petitions. They even wrote to the Russian ambassador complaining that the treaty was being violated. You remember during the Cold War, the American government was always saying, "We don't trust these Bolsheviks. And so we have to have on-site inspection to make sure that they're not cheating in any test ban or nuclear arms reduction agreement." And of course, the Soviet government never agreed, so they never got such a treaty. The Aleuts wanted the same thing. They wanted Russian on-site inspection of Alaska to make sure that the Americans didn't cheat. And they even wrote to the Russian ambassador in Washington, D.C., asking for such a thing. They didn't get that either, because the American government would have never accepted it. But the very idea that out in the Aleutian Islands they were thinking of such solutions to their problems shows a good deal of intelligence and ingenuity. The last thing I'll say about this is that in the 1940s, most of you know, the Aleuts from the Unangan people, the people in the green area, were evacuated, supposedly for their own good and protection, from their homes as the Japanese invaded Attu and took all the people there to Japan, where most of them died in prisoner of war camps. So the others, supposedly for their own protection, were evacuated to Southeast Alaska and put in mining camps, abandoned mines and abandoned canneries, usually without heat, medicine, and a whole lot of necessary things, where a fourth of them died. So it was almost as bad being taken by the Americans as it was being captured by the Japanese, in retrospect. That wasn't the intent, to be sure, but that's how it worked out. And afterwards, 25 years afterwards, there was an appeal to the American Congress. The Unangan people wanted, first of all, an apology. They said, this was wrong. We were American citizens. We shouldn't have been treated this way. So they didn't want compensation. They didn't want money. And our churches were ransacked or destroyed. The church at Atka, built by St. Yaakov, possibly with an iconostasis that he himself had carved and painted, was burned by the US Navy without giving the people any notice or any chance of retrieving any of its treasures before they set it afire. In fact, they burned the whole village of Atka, a kind of scorched earth policy, when the Atkins had fled to the hills and were in hiding and returned that evening only to find their whole village in flames. So they came to their camps in Southeast Alaska only with the clothes on their backs, because they had all their own belongings and their church. So they said, we want the churches rebuilt. We want reparations for the churches. They didn't ask even for reparations for themselves. I attended some of the hearings. Arthur Goldberg, former Supreme Court Justice and UN Ambassador and Secretary of Labor under John Kennedy, a man who had been prominent in American government for some time, was the chairperson of these hearings, and they met in Anchorage and in the Pribilof Islands on Alaska and elsewhere. And I was asked to go present information about the church and what had been lost. But I had the opportunity to listen to the Aleuts talk. And one man said, what really hurt us when we came home was the house had been looted by the GIs who had been sent there to defend us. And they had taken all our icons and all our family pictures. The pictures were useless to them, but they were irreplaceable to us. And then this man said, and they took all my father's darkroom equipment, and they took my mother's violin and clarinet, and they would have taken our piano too if they could have got it out the door. And I thought to myself, the darkroom equipment, the violin and clarinet, what does that say about Aleut life on the Pribilof Islands in 1939? They were still like the people Veniaminov had educated. They are still very much like the descendants, the ancestors of St. Yaakov Nesviatov. And they said all these things really without remorse, without bitterness, without hostility. They wanted justice. They never got their apology. And the United States Congress voted them personal compensation at the rate of however much an Aleut was being paid in 1942. Since the average Aleut earned $4,000 a year and they were in the camps for 2 years, they calculated that each Aleut in 1991 was eligible for $8,000. Notice, if you had owed the IRS $4,000 since 1942, interest and penalties by now would have been in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they didn't pay that money for many more years later, so that by the time the payments actually came, $8,000 after 50 years, only a tiny fraction of the survivors were still alive. The longer they waited to pay, the fewer payments they had to make. At the same time, there was a Japanese reparation bill before the US Congress, and Japanese were compensated at $20,000 per person. Again, not a lot of money, but what does it say? Aleuts are only worth about 40% of what a Japanese American is worth. The injustice of all this, in other words, just seems to me to go on and on. The churches are being rebuilt on Alaska. They spent almost $1 million refurbishing the cathedral where St. Innocent labored. It was rededicated last year. And this year is the 200th birthday of St. Innocent Veniaminov. August 26th, just a few weeks away, there will be a national celebration marking the 200th birthday of St. Innocent Veniaminov at St. Tikhon's Monastery. There have been already celebrations and congresses and special museum exhibits in his honor in Russia, and there will be one touring Alaska this fall and winter to make all Alaskans aware of the missionary and scientific educational contributions of St. Innocent Veniaminov. Governor Tony Knowles has declared this year, 1997, the year of St. Innocent Veniaminov. So it's an official thing, an official, even if most Alaskans don't know, certainly Orthodox Alaskans should know, that this occasion of his 200th birthday is not going by without some celebration and recognition. Well, let's take our break and we'll come back to talk about the theological ramifications of all of this for a few minutes before we quit.